Mr. Batson, Reel 2. So, your early practice, we were talking about your training at Ganges, HMS Ganges, at Shotley.
Yeah, yeah.
You were saying that the practice you'd had with the air rifle, you got used to it.
Yeah.
But when you went to the 303, it was still valuable to you.
Yeah, so it...
How did you find shooting the 303?
Well, it was... I'd have to kick on it, but if you got used to holding it tight into your shoulder and keeping your pressure on like that, when you pull the trigger, you more or less went back with the gun without... If you left a bit of a space between the shoulder and the gun, it'd give you a bang, whereas if you kept it tight into your shoulder, you went back with the velocity or the kickback on the gun.
Did you do quick firing as well, or was it just aimed
there, fun? There was only single shots there, but the very amusing incident when I got down to Eastney.
We'll come to that, right. Yeah. What about any other training? Bayonet practice? Bayonet?
Well, you'd learn how to put the bayonet on and take it off and a bit of sticking, but every time you see a war film about training for that, they always showed you plenty of bayonet practice, into stuffing the bayonet into a sack or something. But we didn't get much of that at all.
What about practicing in sort of keeping your kit clean, sharp polishing your boots and kit inspections? Did you have kit inspections, getting ready for
inspections?
How strict were they? What was it like getting ready for them?
It was same as a lot more things. They had to miss things out in some cases because of time. And to get through the day's training and everything, certain things had to go by the board, but more or less you got to know what discipline was.
So the kit inspections wasn't a big thing?
No, it was big enough when you had to try and get everything cleaned up and all in order and folded and spread out on the end of your bed ready for the whoever was in charge of you to come and have a look.
Now, were you allowed out at all?
Yes, about 2, possibly 3 nights a week. But not terribly lot, because of buses and things like that. You were 12 miles out of Ipswich, and you used to have to go on the bus and have a night out. It talks about drinking beer and things like that, but we never really had enough money to go drinking beer to that extent. What we had was enough money to happen to have half a pint of beer and fish and chips on the way home at night. But apart from that, we didn't have a lot of money to spend.
And you've got a story here about once when you got back with your friend Joe. Can you tell us that?
Joe Goodfellow from Chesterfield. And early on in the book, I don't know if I mentioned that... He was on the station at Derby when we got to Derby, and he was shouting my name, and I found him, and it was Joe Goodfellow that I knew was before we left Chesterfield, and he lived at Boythorpe, and he was very quiet, and until he got roused, but people used to try and take advantage of him. And Joe was no mug. He come back home. Me and him always used to go ashore together. And we come back and we found these blankets had been taken off his bed and hidden away somewhere. And Joe asked for him in a nice manner, saying, could you give me the blankets back? We want to... You know, get to sleep, because it was, by that time, it was late at night. And these two lads from London, one of them had done a bit of boxing, and they were pulling Joe's leg and trying to get him excited, and so when it finally got to see they weren't going to hand over these blankets, Joe says, well, we'll get it sorted out sometime, and why do this? And he more or less invited them to either hand the blankets over or fight for them. And they thought he was a bit of a quiet lad, he couldn't be much harm. They thought they were going to... They always thought these... Early on in the war, anyway, they always thought these Londoners that they were a bit better off than the country yokels from up north. And Joe said, well, we'll sort it out. And so that's when these two admitted that they'd got his blankets, and they handed them over on the supposition that they were going to fight him next day. And so we've more or less fixed up for them to go in the ring. If there are any grudge fights, you'd get it set up, and one of the POs would act as a referee, and you'd sort it out that way. But in between, and between that night and the next day, they asked for volunteers for the amateur boxing. And every so many months, like, you'd get the best out of the barracks and things like that. And anybody who wanted to volunteer for the boxing could go in and have a bash. So these two, instead of fighting Joe on his own, they more or less lined up with the rest of them for this here fighting. Well, Joe went in, and I think he won about three contests, one after the other. And although his style wasn't ever so great, he used to manage to either knock him down or win on points. And these two lads from London, they started to look a bit pale round the gills when they saw what Joe were doing to him, to his other opponents. And they used to give you so many war bonds, whatever. You get these, worth a shilling or two. It's
saving stamp things.
But yeah, it's some kind of a thing like that. And Joe won about £2 or £3 worth, which was quite a lot of money in them days. And they didn't gain anything in money, but they lost a hell of a lot of pounds in sweat when they saw that Joe was what he could do to them.
He didn't actually fight them, though.
No, they backed off after that. And yet one of them had been an amateur boxer before he joined the Navy. But he wouldn't have a go with Joe.
Now, another story I just want to pick up was when you found the cockroaches in the kitchen. Can you tell us that story? That's a good story.
Yeah, I couldn't understand it, and even today I still can't understand it. I was cleaning... they used to detail you off to go and work in the petty officer's mess or any place where they wanted any labour. They'd detail you off and you had to go and do it. Well, I was washing pots in the galley at the petty officer's mess, and there was a hell of a bang, and I dashed over to look through the window up towards Ipswich, and I could just see the debris coming down, and it was a coaster that had gone up the river to Ipswich and got blown up on a mine that a German bomber had released sometime weeks or days before, I don't know. But they actually shot this German bomber down and went and had a look at that somewhere on the side of the shore. And this German bomber got shot down, but the mines that it had dropped in the river on the way up to Ipswich caught this coaster and blew that up. And I went and been working in the officer's mess, at that time I was lucky enough to be able to climb up to a window and see the debris coming down from this bang. And I don't know if it was, I don't think it was the same day, but sometime during the week or so after, I would looked up at the ceiling on this kitchen. It was just a room partly at the side of the cookhouse, and I think it was part of the cookhouse, and yet it wasn't, you know what I mean? It was an adjoining room, and saw these cockroaches all in one corner of the room up on the ceiling. So I dashed away and got a ladder, step ladder, and I'm getting up there with a brush when the Apache officer comes and says, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to get them cockroaches down. They shouldn't be in here in the kitchen." He says, come down, leave them alone." I says, "Why?" He said, "If the chief PO comes in, he'll have your guts for garters." Well-known expression in the Navy. He says, "Leave them alone. You can't touch them." I says, "Why not? The vermin, they won't move." And he says, "You've got to leave them alone." And I did. And why this particular chief PO, and he was in charge of the other POs, as you might say, what he said was, that was valid. You had to do what he said, even amongst POs. And it was never explained to me why this particular chief would want to have cockroaches on the ceiling. Something that's supposed to do with superstition, but I never found out, and nobody's ever told me why. I don't think anybody ever did know why, except for the chief PO. He must have known he'd got a reason for it.
Now, you had vaccinations, didn't you, while you were there?
Yes.
And some people had quite a bad reaction. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Everybody... I've still got my mark here.
On after your right arm.
You only stuck a little needle in you, and then it opened out to about as big as today's one pence piece. It finished up about that size. But these sick birth attendants that were doing the jabbing, they were supposed to ask you, did you use your left hand or your right hand? And they'd put it, if you was left-handed, they'd put it in your right hand. And if you were right-handed, they'd put it in your left hand. So that you'd still got some use in your hands, because it did affect you really hard. One thing they should have done at that time, and they never did, they should have took your tight-fitting vests off and left them off, so that you didn't have them. Many of these vests and things, they got ruined because you're trying to take them off, and you had to cut them off with a finish because your arm swelled up that much. And this particular lad, the sick birth attendants were talking to his mates and not taking a lot of notice, saying next please and so on, and then they give this lad his jab, and then said, "Oh, I'm supposed to ask you which arm you use," and of course this lad told him, and it was actually the opposite arm to which he'd already stuck him in, so he stuck one in there as well, so that meant he had two jabs. And that was through the attendant not paying attention to what he was doing. And this lad had to go in hospital over the weekend. They give it you on Friday, I think it is, so that you couldn't go anywhere Saturday and Sunday. If you wanted the day off, you didn't get it. Your mother's laid in bed all day. And this chap finished up in hospital, and it was weeks and weeks in hospital before he came round from this thing. And he could have died through having these two injections at one time.
How bad did you feel?
I felt pretty rough. Yeah, I managed to get me best and these tight-fitting shirts. You had the white shirt with a bit of blue band on the top, you know. They were pretty tight-fitting, same as most of the Navy clothes were. I believe it's to the tradition of if you got in the sea, you'd got tight-fitting clothes, you could still swim in them. But why the wide bell-bottom trousers, I don't know. You couldn't swim in them. But
what about swimming training? Did you have to learn swim, or could you already swim?
I could swim, and you had proficiency things.
Was there a test, do you remember?
Yes, if you passed it. I don't know if they give you a certificate or not, but...
What was it? How strict a test was it?
Trying to pull somebody with your arms under their armpits and swimming using your feet to transfer and drag somebody towards the side of the bath. The crawl and the overarm stroke and side stroke and...
And you could do all that?
Yeah.
And was there when you finished, you know, at Ganges, was there a passing out parade? Or was it just finish?
Well, I know we did go on parade, but whether it was a passing out parade, I think it might have just lined you up one Friday afternoon and said, that's it, you're going through to different bases. And they were shipped from there to all over the place whatever you were proficient at, they'd send you to something, some went to stoker's classes, some went to seaman's classes, and the seaman branch covers the gunnery and navy ratings anyway. In the seaman's branch, that covers gunnery. And if you were a seaman, you could be a gunner as well. But stoker's engineering were a separate branch. And, of course, some went to telegraphy and things like that. And we got shipped out to all over the place.
And how did they select people? Did they do aptitude tests? Or was it just...
I should think so. They more or less, each day after you'd done, the PO would mark you down. Not, you wouldn't ever see this paper, but I suppose they put marks on you for what you could do and what you couldn't do on these papers, and then they'd be studied at the end of the course to see where you was going to go to.
Now, you were sent in September to HMS Excellent on Whale Island.
Whale Island, yeah.
And was that what you wanted? Were you pleased about that?
Yes, I wanted to be a gunner.
And what happened when you got there? You lost your pal Joe, though, before...
Yes, I don't know where... I never... You know, from that day to this, I don't know ever... where he finished up. But in all the time I was training, right up to the time of being prisoner, I only had one weekend leave, which was, say, Friday night to get back Sunday evening. I only had one weekend leave because I was taken prisoner after that.
So what happened when you reported in Portsmouth? Well, in Portsmouth...
I think there was... Three of us got shipped down to Portsmouth, and we two trains not running to time and us missing them, we were late when we got there. We should have arrived sometime about tea time, but instead of that it was 7:30 at night and possibly later. And the only place we could find was HMS Victory. And we went up to the gate there and told him we were due to report there. And he said, we've no record of you, like, because we should have reported to Excellent, which is quite away from Victory. It's up the... It's a long way off. And when you're new to a town, you don't know which way to go. And after a lot of argument, and it was getting later on at night, the PO said, well, come on. We'll find you a bed for tonight. Well, you've got your hammocks, which you could sling anywhere, where there was a couple of hooks. And he said, took us up these stairs and said, sling your hook on one of these plays. Well, most of the lads that weren't going to show were in bed anyway, and in their hammocks. And... we slung the hammocks up, and during the night I wanted to go to the toilet, so I gets up and tried to find the heads. And eventually I found them, but coming back, I must have took a different turning, I don't know, and I finished up with this breath of fresh air. In fact, it was very windy, blowing straight through. I thought, where's the blinking heck's that coming from? And then I felt a rope under my fingers, about hand height, and I could see daylight. And I looked down, and we was on possibly the fourth floor. I don't know. Must have been at least 30 foot down. And I looked down, and there was only this bit of rope stretched across a blooming great opening, and it appears the German bombers had been across and knocked the end of the building off and left this blooming great gaping hole. And the only thing they'd got across was a piece of rope. And if it hadn't been a moonlit night, I suppose I should have finished up and down over the thing. But this rope stopped me, and I managed to get back, find my way back to the hammock. Because when you're in a strange place and hammocks all over the place and you don't know which floor you're on or what, we didn't get much sleep at all. And when it come to breakfast time, next morning, like, when we all got up, we got in lines up with the rest of them on these tables, and the PO said, "You're not on our books, you know." So he said, "You should be at HMS Excellent." But anyway, he took pity on us and he gave us some breakfast. And then when the lorry come to take us up to HMS Excellent, the PO says, "Here, take them and get rid of them and drop them from a great height." I'm not bothered. And that's how he got rid of us to go to HMS Excellent. And once we got there, we found out that you had to double everywhere. That was for naval discipline and to make you know that you was in the senior training base for gunners anywhere in the world. It was renowned for it, really.
So Dublin's not running, but very fast walking, is it?
Yes, and running, yeah.
What was the island like? Because Whale Island is actually a sort of island, isn't it?
Yes, it's when the tide's in, it's sea all round it. But when it's out, there's a very muddy stretch. You could walk from the mainland across to the island if the tide was out, depending on high tide or low tide and that. And I wouldn't fancy walking through there because it seemed to be, looking at it, I should say there's about 18 inches of sludge to go through, and I shouldn't fancy that at all. And as regards Dublin about, that's if you was ever left on your own to go anywhere, you had to keep moving pretty fast. And one thing that struck me in particular was a chap on crutches. And he had to move at a pretty fast rate to keep up with the tradition.
Now, what were the barracks like? Or was it barracks? Or
yeah,
huts?
There was some huts. There was barracks as well as huts.
Which were you in?
And I was in huts.
What were they like?
It was not too bad. Similar to any barracks anywhere. Everywhere was clogged up with people, and they made use of every bit of space. And one thing I remember about it was at the Rummishu time, each class or each hut or whatever, the PO would draw the ration for the men that were entitled to it. And I wasn't entitled to it, so it didn't bother me at all. But when they'd drawn the rations for the hut, you'd go on parade and it was dished out, and if there was any left over at all, After it had been watered down already, it weren't neat rum anyway. And the PO that had got the leftover rations of rum, in the sight of an officer, used to have to go and pour them down this grate on the square. Well, I wouldn't say it was a square, but anyway, he'd pour it down the grate so it would run away with any rainwater or anything like that. But these POs had been there a year or two, or some of them, and they made a special bucket. And if it hadn't been raining and things like that, if you, when they poured this rum ration down that was spare, at a later date, they'd go and collect it. And, of course, share it out between them. And he got caught at it, and he was reduced to the ranks of... he was severely reprimanded anyway, the one that they caught taking it out.
Now, what about your gunnery training? That's why you were there. Tell me about that.
Well, it was pretty hectic. You did a hell of a lot on Whale Island itself, both with small arms as well as 3-inch and 4-inch shells and things like that.
Tell me about the small arms stuff first. What were you learning there?
Well, mostly taking machine guns and that to bits and putting them back together again. But your main training for that, for small arms, was done at Eastney. It's now a Royal Marines training base. And all the barracks that we used for the Navy, you had a big long line of guns on the seashore facing out to sea. And I don't know just how many guns it'd be, but anything from rifles, machine guns, power-operated turrets with, I think there was 0.5s. And you sat in it like as though you sat in a cockpit of an aeroplane, and you got this stick coming up through the middle, and you put your hand through the, and your left or right, whichever way you wanted it to turn.
And this was at Eastney?
Eastney. And up or down like that to elevate or depress the gun. And the PO used to take your whatever particular gun you were trying at that particular moment. And I'd watched him with the other lads that was their turn before me, and he'd give them a pat on the shoulder, like, and they'd cease fire and get out, and then it was a turn for the next one. And when I got in, it was my turn, you were firing at a drogue that was being towed behind a plane that had come from one of the RAF stations, I think. And there was quite a long length of cable behind the plane, so that he could, and he used to fly in a straight line, straight up and down. And as you went across following this drogue, as he got further past you, of course, the thing, you were getting closer to the end of the plane. And I got in and firing at this drogue, and all I was interested in is shooting this drogue, and it came fluttering down, and I thought I'd shot it down. And with no drogue to shoot at, like, I ceased fire, and then I got out. In fact, I was dragged out. The PO got hold of me, and he dragged me straight out of the cockpit, and he was playing hell with me, and he said, "Did you hear me tell you to stop?" And in actual fact, I didn't, but it was pulling me in the shoulders and in the middle of the back and everywhere, trying to get me to stop firing, because if I'd have kept on firing, I'd have shot the end of the plane off. And they were all playing out with me, because they cancelled the firing for that day. And the pilot came by and he said, "Get that idiot off that gun and sent him over to shoot at some Germans, because I'm not coming back today. And he didn't come back to it. And the rest of the lads that hadn't had a firing practice, they weren't very pleased with me. And the PO, he thought I must have felt him, but I didn't. And all I could see with that drove in.